that are waiting to be asked. Anyone? Anything picking up from any of the themes that we were discussing in the previous Q&A session that we want to pick up from? And there were some hands up before the at the back.
This question is for Daisy. My name is Zoe. I'm a science writer and I work with Real Science. As you apply your design eye to different problems and trying to find solutions, do you have a kind of dream puzzle that somebody might set to you to try and do it?
No, I think that's why I'm not a designer. I'm actually an artist, completely. I think what I'm trying to do is to open up the space to see if there are... I'm not saying I have any of the solutions. I certainly don't. And I think I'm just trying to define a set of questions or a way of working that potentially look to open it up to other people. I think that designers are good problem solvers, and that's kind of the definition of designers, sort of making things functional. So there's a natural correspondence between the disciplines, and we're used to, there's a slide I often show which shows so you have mechanical engineering and industrial design, structural engineering and architecture, and where does synthetic biology sit on that? And synthetic biologists are probably designers themselves, so maybe there's retraining or different ways of thinking if when the field develops, if it is going to go towards this idea of decoupling from the kind of molecular scale to the actual function. But I'm not necessarily the one to answer those challenges.
I have a question for Melanie.
Can I just ask people to say their names?
Or sorry. My name is Deborah Gale, and I'm at King's College in public policy, actually. I was curious, does your group spearhead research, or do you do collaboration with research institutes? And I wonder how you come up with where you focus your attention.
We do research, we have our own laboratories, so on site we have lab schools from various disciplines. We get most of our form, get a fair amount of funding through the MOD, through the government, but we are encouraged in all that to work with academia wherever possible. So we do have collaboratives within the UK, we have a number of UK universities. We don't want to reinvent the wheel by doing research within the STL that is being done outside of academia or industry or anywhere else. And if somebody's already got a subject that we can use already in production or in research, then if we can agree and buy it off the shelf, then that's what we do, rather than do our own research. But where there are areas where people can't do that kind of research for whatever reason, then we will take our lead and do that as well.
James Hutchinson, Royal Society of Chemistry. Firstly, thank you for a set of really interesting talks this afternoon. Perhaps one question I want to sort of put to the whole panel is that from a sort of a chemistry perspective, there's a large number of sort of chemists working in the area of synthetic biology, but maybe taking a slightly different, coming out from a slightly different viewpoint, but using a lot of the same sort of tools and techniques. So just sort of wondering from your perspective whether there's sort of value or an opportunity to bring together scientists that are working in the areas of various aspects of synthetic biology that are approaching it from different viewpoints, so bringing together the chemists with biologists, etc., to share best practice, but also sort of at a pre-competitive level as well, to kind of work out whether there are areas for collaboration.
You know, you're kicking something there. So, I mean, basically, biological systems are genetically encoded chemistry. So there's a very close link. The origins of molecular biology comes from chemistry and physics. There's a very close historical and practical link between chemistry and biology and hence synthetic biology. But I think you already see quite a large number of interactions between chemists and biologists and engineers. I think that everyone brings their own preconceptions and their own skills and outlooks to their particular approach. And I think for those who are chemically inspired, if you like, you see a tendency towards chemically based self-reproducing systems, looking at new materials, which might be inspired by chemical properties. I think, in a way, chemistry is more advanced in terms of grasping the applications of their field than biologists are. So in most chemistry departments, you find a more direct link with industry and application-driven science. And so they are coming to the field with often a strong interest in using biologically inspired ways of getting towards some kind of chemical inspired end. From the biological sector, you find perhaps a stronger interest in the wackier aspects of the biosphere and how you might bring novel activities into the same field. So there's so much potential for interaction, and you are starting to see that.
It's good to see, yeah. Particularly a lot of the tools. The techniques are quite sort of similar, but there's sort of an opportunity there to share sort of best practice almost.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you talk to or see a group of biologists and chemists interacting, and engineers for that matter, they all come with very different viewpoints and different social approaches to the things. But you see a lot of richness coming out of the interactions.
Thanks.
Susie asked me for the science piece. I have a question for the whole panel. What do you see in the future as being the chief driver of the development of biology technologies? Is it going to be defence? Is it going to be more security? Or is it going to be civilians and communities?
I think health always has to be a big driver because there are so many hard questions that still be asked. But I think we're only limited to people's imagination. And if you think about the kind of people's imagination and the ideas that happen,
I think it's very controversial. I think the biggest driver is probably money. So rather than any particular application, and that's just something that, as an outsider, I've felt a privileged position to kind of sit in a lot of discussions that go on about synthetic biology. And there seems to be various, I'm always interested in possible futures and variations of the future rather than one particular one. But there seems to be different ways it could go, and that will impact how it turns out. And whether things get locked down in IP and can't move because the kind of fundamental kind of structure of creating a different kind of way of doing science is actually allowed to grow, which is something I find really interesting in the kind of the ideology of synthetic biology, or whether things, if it just everything gets turned into patent patents, then it will not work the way that it's being envisaged.
And I agree that I think there's clearly that the main motivators are financial at this point. And you see in this, particularly in the US, with the investment in synthetic biology, this broad term is up in the billions already. Most of the investment has been driven initially by decree between the last days of the Bush administration, where you've got the need for ethanol in addition to fuels. And so that need to create that source of material in an assured market has driven large investments from all the oil companies, who are investing very large amounts in field terms, but in terms of their own turnover and profits, they're relatively small amounts. And so you've seen this, one might say, distorted move into biofuels, but you've also, most biofuels, there's been a turning point in the last year or so. So many of the small companies and some larger companies that have been making large investments in microbial chassis, mainly algal and bacterial systems, to modify them for production of biofuel molecules, have found that, well, the markets and the practicalities of making million-gallon scale biofuels are just either impractical or difficult or expensive, and most of them have made this shift towards higher-value products. And so they're hedging their bets quite sensibly, and I think you'll see an unexpected output in terms of bioproduction of higher value chemicals, monomers for polymer production, substrates for other chemical inspired processes coming out of renewable sources, which will feed into existing chemical processes, I think. But also you see that the other issue is that that's using a conventional biotechnology framework, so using conventional investment models and profit being what the main a motivator. And I think one of the things that a number of us on the academic side of the field would hope from synthetic biology, but not, maybe not seeing as much as we would hope, is this idea that you've got essentially three components, or potentially three components, which could be shared and which could contribute to a democratization of biotechnology, to a sharing of the base technology for many different applications. And I think our maybe somewhat idealistic view of the field would be that you'd be generating a sort of a biomaterials-based software industry, that you would have reprogramming biological systems, and you would be looking at small groups of people, which would be limited essentially merely by creativity rather than resources, that would be producing systems that could reprogram biological systems to produce things of value or interest, and where this could be, as you saw with microelectronics and the software industry, a proliferation of small companies which are created by definition and which are producing things, which undermine in some respects larger. You see a lot of volatility in the early microelectronics industry and software industries, but you see also the emergence of monolithic companies which complement. So there's a lot of interesting scenarios that could happen, a lot of which are dependent on the financial models that apply and the regulatory models. So I'm not quite sure where we're going, but we could veer from some kind of cementing of existing biotechnology practice where you have large monolithic companies which control everything through to a more democratic and a diverse industry. So, but that's, I think, anyone can say where it's going to go.
I think actually in answer to Zoe's question before, there's one example that I've really been thinking about. It's like the idea of the biofuel producing bacteria that's in a vat somewhere in California, all locked up safely away, and the fuel that it's fed is sugarcane from Brazil. So you're setting up an infrastructure where you're growing sugarcane in Brazil to be shipped to America, to be fed to a bacteria, to then be shipped outwards. And it just seems such a crazy way to be designing a system. And if things get locked down too soon, and that will be the precedent. And that seems really terrifying to me as sort of a technological point of view, that there's, you know, that doesn't seem like a good way to make a disruptive technology, but from a design perspective, I think it's the same.
But I guess the question is, because I mean, the one example there would be LS9,
yeah,
they're working in California, taking Brazilian sugar, but now they're producing not biofuels, but say cosmetic precursors, which are of higher value, but maybe, I mean, there's the issue of distortion of the markets, what the first world is prepared to pay for. And I mean, clearly that applies to across the board as well.
So maybe that's designed itself out of the system already. Maybe common sense prevails, maybe that's.
Another thing to consider as well is all the waste streams too. There's a lot of research going on now into not just using the carbohydrate starch components crops, but actually using all of the other bits that we throw away and actually converting those into not only fuels but also these higher value products as well. Mm-hmm. So that could be an interesting spin, you know, rather than having to import materials from far reaches of the world, we use all the waste that we've got to throw out of the day.
And someone with two projects about poo, I'm a good thing.
I think also the idea of having sustainable production systems where you're diverting materials, so it's not a particular product from a crop that you're harvesting and the rest we don't know what to do with.
Exactly.
The idea of designing things and then probably won't be designed, they'll be scavenged and utilised because people can make money out of them. But I think that's a very important and necessary aspect. And the other thing is that with the ability to start to reprogram biological systems, you can start to build interdependencies. So we're used to this idea of, you know, just the way we just frame it, producing a crop. I think in a very short period of time, 20 year or more time scale, we're going to be creating crop systems which have individual organisms which are tied together by forms of engineered mutualism, which have benefits. You see this in natural systems all the time. I mean, most plant systems have symbiotic or mutual associations with fungal and bacterial systems, which improve nutrition and access to soil, etc. And this, the potential benefits of this are very clear and have great benefits and potentially transformative in terms of our agricultural systems. And these kind of things take us back to, in a way, an earlier stage of human technologies, where we're using things, you know, like sourdough technologies or pickling technologies or like yogurt, or, you know, things where you've got biological resources or transformations, biotransformations, which are themselves don't require sterility. They don't require a large-scale, sterile, vaccine infrastructure. They are self-maintaining. And I think that's both cheaper and potentially more sustainable. And that kind of technology, you can see, you know, away from these kind of simple systems like making yogurt, can be taken towards, you know, on a wider scale, as an example, crop systems where you have weed control by mutual interactions between plants, microbes, insects, etc. These are all quite feasible to think of at least.
Steer things a little for a moment on kind of the bio-era, bio-terror question which kind of come. I'll deliberately set up a straw man that we can pull apart and critique if necessary. But just what are, often in the media things, it's been posed, well, with open biology, open source access, things like that, people can move around in their garages, get information from the internet, order it, do all manner of stuff in their own back garden, so to speak, and therefore making a bioweapon that much more easy to obtain, to release, whether on purpose or by accident. I know the President's Commission report was criticised for not advocating kind of a stop on research, because in response to those kind of issues they were saying we need to let the research develop some more in order to be able to better understand it. Are those realistic threats? If they are going to be threats, are they 7 years down the line, given the rate of progress and knowledge? Are they unnecessary concerns? Are they real concerns? Catherine, perhaps I'll stick with you from a regulatory perspective. How do you respond to those kind of questions?
I think the real concern still is less the kind of bioterror or the individual, depending on what states might do, because that's still where the resources and expertise are based. I think synthetic biology has become a concern, not just in its own right, but because it's a sort of kind of cumulative things within biotechnology, within the life sciences, within other fields like chemistry, that will allow, if it's wanted to be misused, it makes it easier. So once you can sort of specify virulence and maybe who your target group is, whether you want to overcome immune responses, that sort of thing, once that's specified, it becomes a lot more desirable to have a weapon in that sense. But I think where the debates go between security and science, I'm not just for openness, is, but if it's not open what's being done, then how do you know what you need to protect yourself against? So, I think the balance is still going to be for openness, for that awareness.
And Jim, if we jump to you, and others chipping as well, how, as a scientist very much working in the field, do you pay to these kind of concerns? Are they realistic concerns, or the time frame, is it going to happen tomorrow, or is it further down the line? Really?
Well, I think there's different levels of concern, both temporally and in terms of, the garage biology movement, DIY bio movement, has both positive and negative aspects. So it's certainly making the work more accessible to many more people, but there also needs to be a level of training and education associated with that. And you've already seen the response in that field. I think there's, in many cases, actually a lot of similarities in terms of an emerging new technology with potential hazards but benefits, with sort of hacking or a cyber defense issues, where in one case you've got, there are many similarities between computer viruses and biological viruses, and many people have made the analogies, and similar strategies are used by the different organisms, if you like, to do damage or to protect against them. And I think, that's one of the major issues, which in terms of biodefense, is the potential to make pathogens or poisons, which might be, say, ethnic-specific, or to target industrial infrastructure. If we're moving more and more towards sustainable technologies, then people's or individual countries' industrial bases are going to be more and more dependent on that. So there's clearly going to be more advantage for state-sponsored bioterrorism, if you like. At this point, the technology is such that it's nothing to really worry about, because people don't have the technical capability to make the kind of things that one would be most scared of. But there's probably a need, and I'm sure the MOD is already dealing with this in some way. I know they are in some sort of horizon scanning exercises, etc. There may be a need to think or lobby for more direct research in defensive countermeasures and the like, or being able to rapidly screen for issues like that.
I mean, I agree with what everybody here has said. Firstly, it's not likely that somebody in the shed is going to be able to build something tomorrow. It needs the kind of resources and funds that you're up to today. Having said that, yes, it was a possibility, and when everything's made public and open, then that means that we're aware of what's out there, as well as what everybody's aware. And as you said, we can then try and second guess what somebody might be doing. So we can detect not just a natural bacteria, but a genetically modified bacteria, something that may naturally be harmless that has been tweaked to make it more pathogenic. And those are the kind of things that we're looking into, is to try and find ways of detecting those kinds of genetically modified organisms. As to sort of synthetically making a pathogen, bacteria or virus, you can synthesize large pieces of DNA and build them together. You can also go out into the environment and pick them up naturally if you're going to let go at some point. I'm not sure that the best source is to build it. Anyway, we can just get it from the environment. So, obviously, one area that we're interested in is detecting all kinds of pathogens and knowing the source of them, which is why there's a big drive now to sequence a whole range of bacteria from different areas, so that we get a feel for what is in the natural population, so that we can detect them when something has been changed artificially.
I just wanted to say the arsenic biosensor, which was in the Ecromy film, has been really interesting, because there's so much discussion. It originally came out of an iGEM project from Edinburgh, was it 2006? That was a team of students inventing an E. coli that would change colour or change the pH level when in the presence of arsenic. So in Bangladesh, there's a real problem with contamination of wells, and this seems an ideal way to kind of test the idea of a biosensor. And I've sat in on a crit that happened at the Rhode Island School of Design, where the design students there were trying to actually design this thing. And when we actually ended up designing the objects that were in that film for the Design Museum this year, and we were designing, you know, what does this arsenic biosensor actually look like? Well, it's, you know, maybe it's a pregnancy test, kind of dipstick. But how all the structures around that thing, you know, if you take it to Bangladesh for someone to be able to test their own water and have that kind of power over the kind of local structures, how do they dispose of it? And if they don't even understand what genetic engineering is, how are they supposed to know how to dispose of this thing and know that it's safe? I mean, everyone just chucks out batteries and laptops and everything, but if this has a life of its own, and however well designed the object is, there's always room for bio error even in that way. And I think that's really interesting, like, how will we actually, is there a fundamental problem with actually releasing the technology in this way? So there's two camps that I see in synthetic biology. There's like, we'll keep it in the lab and it'll be really safe, or there's the kind of bioremediation, we'll, you know, get them to clean up pollution and oil and use them out in the field like this. But how that will actually happen is something I think much bigger than the technology itself. It's like, how do you educate people to know, to be able to use this technology in the best possible way? I think it's a really kind of big area for discussion.
As we come into land, so to speak, one thing I'd like to pose to the panel in closing is, perhaps as has already been picked up, kind of the US seems to become a world leader on this, UK beginning to, perhaps what they would say from their different respective fields what kind of two top issues would be appropriate for the UK to kind of address with regard to synthetic biology. Now, obviously, kind of off the cuff kind of response, so I'll put that out there. Are there now, as we come into the kind of the last 10 minutes or so, any further comments or in comments and questions from the audience that you'd like to pose?
I just want to make the point that I think that the analogy with the computer info technology is obviously an appropriate metaphor. But it, don't you think it's going to be self-correcting in the same way that WikiLeaks, you know, became the de facto expose, if you will, on everything that was happening that wasn't supposed to be open to between governments, for example, you know, and, but we have to come to a point where governments are talking, you know, where the intelligentsia is talking, so that the digital exclusion doesn't deny people access to things where you don't even have the sanitation hygiene, for example, in your example, when that's not been addressed already by that population. So I think that there is a, you know, the discourse isn't even out there yet, you know, where everybody is communicating on the same.
But I think if you look at the analogy, pursue it in terms of current licensing practices and the practicalities of sharing information in the digital world versus the biological world. So, I mean, because of connections, I mean, there's still a wide disparity between first and third world in terms of access to computers, etc., information.
The whole digital exclusion.
But even so, information exchange is cheap now. But if you look at the biological equivalent, the sharing of biological resources, for example, is locked up. You try and do anything in an academic lab, you've got to sign materials transfer up to here. You need a lawyer to deal with all of the transfer materials, because it's the whole field is based on this idea that if you create some kind of novel use for a component, the first thing you do is you patent that component. And this is every university on the planet, essentially, is madly patenting materials, trying to license those materials to companies who are then locking it up.
So it's just, you know, more and more closed concentric circles.
That's not to say it's not the same in the digital world. It's just that the information, I mean, the basic technology enables exchange. So you've got the hardware and to some degree the software. The software's not even patented, it's copyright. So you've got this, and there's a lot of piracy and other things which help even the balance out, essentially, and you've got open source software. And, that, and in a way, the sort of Linux and other open software development programs is an inspiration in synthetic biology, that you have the availability of operating systems and software packages. Certainly in the academic world, open source software has a major impact in terms of enabling technologies and bringing communities together for further development. And at the moment, there's not really, outside of IGEM, there's not really an equivalent island of sanity, I would say. And it's beset by a very much a financially motivated model, which is all directed towards commercial exploitation of the first world. And the only way I could see out of this is that if the development cycle becomes faster, that, you know, the moment to get a biotechnologically inspired product onto the market costs, depending on your market, the tens of millions to hundreds of millions if it's a pharmaceutical product. And it's very expensive to get something to the point where you can sell it, partly because of regulation and legal issues and testing, etc. And clearly that's not the case in the software industry.
But it did happen, that compression, that Moore's Law, if you will, that all occurred already, where originally technology explosion is very, very finite. Things move very, very slowly.
Yeah, but all of the software, I'm thinking more, not so much the hardware, but the software. The thing about hardware in the computer industry is that you sell the components. Yeah. Biology is self-reproduced. You can't sell them. You can license them, but you can't sell them. And you can't make chips, which you can then sell at $10 a pop. Mm-hmm. You can't, because, you know, microprocessors, hundreds of dollars, hundreds of thousands. So you make money by selling the components. In biology, you can sell them once, maybe, but after that, you've lost them, and you have to license them. That's why you've got this difference in models. But it acts as a... And the only way you're going to get the industry to survive is if people make money out of it. So you need to have some way of maintaining the licensing and the generation of wealth, but you need some way of not stifling the industry. I mean, well, that's my viewpoint, obviously. But you could imagine that you would have a two-tier system where you have open source components, but the applications are licensed.
Okay, my
name's Zoe. But since the assertion that the correct metaphor is with a computer, I've often heard the criticism made that synthetic biology is always using the language of computer science. You see people talk about logic gates and circuits and whatnot, but biological systems are not computers, and perhaps it might be a misplaced metaphor, or perhaps the wrong system by which synthetic biology should evolve, because computers were built from scratch by people. But living systems are things that we are now adapting and using. So if we put synthetic organisms out there for use, they will change or evolve by them, or it's not quite the same system. I mean, how might you respond to that criticism?
Well, certainly living systems process information. They are formally computers, but they're not von Neumann-type linear processing systems.
There's lovely diagrams with, like, you know, here's the circuit, and these are little parts. But as you know, knowing about biology, even a process like photosynthesis requires, you know, hundreds.
I mean, I think one way of answering your question in a compact way is that Tom Knight himself, who's a computer scientist, he was in MIT since he was 14, he's a prodigy of sorts. He was involved in a lot of the early development work for processors and for network analysis and construction through the 60s and 70s at MIT. Through the 70s and 80s, he became increasingly interested in amorphous computing. So it's a different type of computing paradigm based on distributed processes and sharing of information. And in fact, the inspiration for that kind of information processing network is very much biological. And there's a much closer analogy there between these amorphous computing units and a biological system, where you have individual processes. So a cell will process its own state, essentially. So it's essentially a membrane, contains space, with gene expression inside the cell, and that's regulated by interactions with everything it sees at the interface, which is quite similar to what these amorphous computing systems are. So that was actually, in a way, not the inspiration and the precedent for Tom taking himself back to undergraduate and postgraduate courses at MIT in biology, because he had no experience in that before. And so the idea that he could bring with him some of these paradigms and these ways of thinking of things into a biological system is not so much based on a literal translation of computational, this is dominant computational thinking into biology. I mean, some people do that, I guess, you said, but his inspiration, I think properly, the inspiration is one of simply information processing with distributed elements where you've got, and the very way you program a biological system is by building a DNA program that you insert into a cell. But if you're talking about either a population of bacteria or a multicellular organism, then the way that program is implemented is dominated by parallelism and feedback between cells and between genetic elements. So it's a very different paradigm, but with that, you get all of the benefits of living systems. You get the potential for self-organization, for self-reproduction, all of the, and you know, it runs on glucose, right? So you've got all of these benefits which are actually very attractive to hardcore engineers. So you've got, you know, the ability potentially to have new paradigms for engineering. And the idea of growing your systems and feeding back into the electronics industry is not so crazy.
Do any of you want to respond to my earlier off-the-cuff question? Top two issues for the UK to address in terms of synthetic biology? Shape discussion, in contrast to, say, the US, I think. It's a wide open question, but just in closing, Catherine.
Yeah, well, the first one I won't say much about because it's been covered, and that's intellectual property.
Okay.
So, how it's going to handle that going forward. But I think that fits to another thing that I think, you know, and this isn't just the UK, it's for the US as well, and a lot of Europe. They see the new technology and they think, great, great for economic growth, and then we've got to be competitive, we've got to, you know, close off what we're doing so we can be competitive, and that somehow further down the line that's going to improve welfare. And I think kind of reverse that to say, it's a new technology that can help us meet welfare goals. By doing that, we'll probably get some economic growth as well, but aim for the welfare goals. I think that then reaches across to these things about what happens in other countries. Well, we don't have to close this off because we can help them meet their welfare goals without worrying that they're going to compete with us.
But how do you get the investment you need for that? It's quite money.
Yeah, more from the states, obviously.
Okay, something perhaps to do with Beethoven wine. Melanie, you say
I guess mine is slightly different. We've been talking about just how open the technology is and how easy it is now to transfer information all over the world very quickly. So we're talking about the UK focus, what I would like to see is that we are out there and collaborating with and making the most of what everybody's got to offer for the benefit of everybody. I think we should be looking outwards to see what's happening outside and what we can bring to the table and get involved with partners and partnerships.
Well, I think my thinking is moulded by the idea, the conception that we're at a turning point in the way we deal with biological technologies, and that we're approaching this this area where we're going to be increasingly using rational engineering principles to modify biological systems, essentially developing the equivalent of a software industry for reprogramming biological systems. And to me, anyway, there's two things that are absolutely critical to this. And when I say critical, I really mean this could succeed or fail for the UK on two issues. One is having an appropriate investment culture which balances the need for investment with the need to share and engage with different parties, because this is a highly interdisciplinary field and it also has potential benefits which are require interaction internationally and with different people in different fields and across academic and industrial sectors. And those kind of interactions are dependent on sharing. And the need to get those kind of foundational technologies in place is the other aspect. So having both a financial investment environment, which promotes access, the kind of things that you saw in the early microelectronics and software industry, but to deal with the structural differences in biology. And secondly, to have a proper investment, a proper concentration on foundational technologies, because I think already you can start to see artemisinin, for example, production of fine chemicals by techniques that are come out of this field has already given people dollar signs in their eyes. So a lot of the investment is now focused increasingly on application, and synthetic biology has now become something of a banner for new biology. So it's actually been somewhat diluted in terms of what it means. So people now think of it as doing the same thing we've done, but faster, better, which may be to some degree true and may not be such a bad thing, but we're actually only at the very beginning of this field. And if, as a community, that foundational technology is not properly supported, it will go elsewhere, and you will see, with this exponential growth in the capacity of the technology, that things will shift offshore. And I think it's at this very early stage, it's the time when you'll see the new Microsofts and the like of this industry being created, at this very early, fragile time in the development field. And so if there's not proper support for that, they will be formed, but elsewhere.
And Daisy?
I think something that's very interesting about the field is the amount of hype. And that's something that interests me is a lot of what I do is tell stories. And that's something I think I find I'm probably partially responsible in some way for telling stories about synthetic biology through my work of futures. But it seems, the field is going so fast that in a way, and I think I've said it so much, like Jim's saying, that of kind of consuming itself through the need to, you've got to attract investment and also make promises, but how do you keep a balance between those two things? And it just as the field expands and it grows faster and faster, it seems, it could self-cannibalise in a way, and that's something that's very... There's such caution about how the public is separate and how you mustn't repeat GM and do the same thing again. and why is, you know, I think there needs to be more, there is a lot of analysis and public dialogue, and I don't think that's necessarily the solution, but a better way to work out why people find it scary or weird or different, or what are those things, and finding a better way to get people to sort of, I don't know, separate the hype and the trust and sort of that it's seen as like the public evil. I don't necessarily, I think that the science is the public, so that needs to be evened out.
So Daisy, in terms of hype, I mean, the UK has been probably marked by a series of inventions which have been made in the UK which have not been exploited properly. Mm. So if you look at recombinant DNA technology from the point of view of like sequencing technology, you have both Fred Sanger's original work, which all of our modern technology is based on. You've got the recent Selexa technology, which was sold off to the US, and monoclonal antibodies, whole series of multi-billion dollar technologies which haven't been exploited.
We're too British about
it. If I can put that on pause, take it to our drinks reception, can I just ask you all to show our appreciation and thanks to our speakers.